And I was like, you know what, let's just both try until we can get the clinic up and running. It was actually the one time we both ovulated at the same time, which was really handy for traveling. Two weeks later,
I was sitting on the couch feeling a bit bloated and I was like, oh, I feel a bit off today.
So that's kind of where our home insemination journey started.
Queers, queens, and in-betweens, hello and welcome to Same Sex, Same Shit. I'm Rochelle, and some weeks I'm joined by my incredible fiancé Maddie, and other weeks I'm joined by powerhouse queer guests. Now, we love to chat all things lesbian, and each week we're going to be sharing that us queers do the same shit as everyone else. But better. Now, this week we're chatting to Hillary and Amy. They are an incredible same-sex couple from New South Wales. They have been on the longest IVF journey of anyone that I've ever heard. They go through home inseminations, known donors, anonymous donors, IUIs, IVF. They have changed multiple clinics. They've had embryos at one, embryos at another. Like, their journey could not be more crazy if it tried, honestly. And I am blown away by the strength that these two beautiful women have held through this whole process. And also, they're navigating when one of them wanted to carry, but they couldn't. And so the other one carried. So there is that roller coaster as well, being in a same-sex couple. Really, they just explain the whole process so incredibly. And as I said, the strength that they've showed. And they go into a lot of detail about home insemination, about their journey. And so if that is something that you're looking at, I think this will be really helpful and really interesting. But yeah, let's have a chat to them. You girls have been through home insemination, IUI, IVF, ICSI, the whole roller coaster. So today we have Hillary and Amy on. They are legends from regional New South Wales, and they're going to tell us a little bit about their IVF story. So welcome, girls, and thank you for sharing your story. Do you want to start a little bit about how the discussion looked around your IVF journey together?
Yeah. Firstly, thanks for having us on. It's really cool to share our story. Our discussion around it, I always wanted kids, and Amy always wanted kids too, but I think I wanted them a lot earlier than Amy. She kind of had that timeline of, you know, get married, then have kids, those kinds of things. So it was a little bit of compromise on our end about that. But we kind of didn't think too much about it. We sort of just thought we're young, fit, healthy, so we'll just head to a clinic and have a baby. And that was kind of where it started.
Yeah. Yeah. I guess we didn't realize how long the process could be. I certainly didn't.
So did you have much prior knowledge about the process? Any kind of friends or family that had been through it? Anything that you'd seen online?
Not really. No. I had one uni lecturer who was also in a same-sex couple, and she told me about her journey to conceiving and ended up going with that clinic first because we were like, right, we know it works, we'll go there. So that was kind of the extent of what we knew. We were the first ones in our friend circles
and family
trying to have babies as well, and then being same sex on top of that, it was just something we kind of dove headfirst into and didn't really think much about it.
Yeah. Punches, basically.
Yeah.
I think that's the nicest way to go. You know, you kind of go in with a little bit of optimism, and you can't plan for these things. Once you go through IVF, you know that there's so much that's out of your control. So there's education, and knowledge is power, but there's only so much that you can kind of go in knowing. So how did you guys make the decision on who would carry?
Well, I guess I'm the older one in the relationship. So I'm a little bit older than Hill. So I guess we thought as well, I have a stable job as well. I can access maternity leave whenever I want to, being a teacher. Hill did want to carry. We both discussed it, and it just seemed right at the time for me to carry.
Yeah.
And that's just the way it started.
Yeah. I was still finishing uni. So it made sense. I mean, we looked at it ways, kind of me not having that stability. It would have probably worked out if I was at home with the kids or things like that. But I think just with Amy being able to access maternity leave, it was the smarter option at the time. Yeah.
Yeah, it makes a huge difference. And I think the journeys that I've kind of been hearing and are friends that we know of, that does come into play massively. Like, you know, that work stability, the financial stability, and having that to fall back on, because yeah, it is such a process. And then having access to maternity leave is a huge help.
Yeah.
And so when you went through the IVF process, briefly in regards to a donor, did you use a known donor, an anonymous donor? How did that process look for you guys with you carrying Amy?
The first clinic we went through, we went for an unknown donor. So just from the sperm bank. I think we even tried a few different ones from the actual clinic.
Yeah. So with the IUIs that we did, you weren't sort of guaranteed a donor. It was just more like where they were at with their donations and how many families had used them. So between the IUIs, I think we've swapped twice in that process, but we also swapped clinics in that time as well.
Okay. All right. So talk me through what the start of your journey kind of looked like.
Well, what, how old was I? 25?
25. Yeah. I was 21 and Amy was 25. Yeah. And we kind of just decided that we were going to go for it. Our first appointment was 4 days after we got engaged, which was nice. It was a busy month.
Yeah.
Yeah, so we kind of just went through the process with the first clinic and they were good. Like everything was on site. Everything was just done through them. We didn't have to travel too much because at the time we were living in the Blue Mountains. So we were quite close to where we needed to be. And yeah, so we did that. We did an IUI through them. And then we learned about the Rainbow Fertility Clinic and we were like, oh, wow, great. You know, an LGBTQI friendly clinic. You know, they kind of would understand everything that we were going through. But we just sort of had trouble navigating all the different places we needed to be for different appointments across Sydney and things like that. So we decided to go back to our other clinic. So that was when we changed donor again with the IUI.
So had you done any IUIs between the clinics? Yeah.
Yeah. So we did one with
two with the first clinic.
And we swapped clinics and did one with them, but found it really challenging to sort of navigate that. And then jumped back to our other clinic.
Original one.
Yeah. The original clinic, yeah. And started IVF.
Yeah, started the process.
So there were 3 failed IUIs in that process. Yeah. And so mentally, how did you guys find navigating the different donors with the different clinics and wrapping your head around that?
The first clinic, they had a very, very detailed description of the donors, which was handy. So you could actually, you know, get a bit of a description of hair colour, eye colour. I think you even received a baby photo.
Yeah, and their profession, what they do now and their interests and all those kinds of things. So in terms of the donors from that clinic, we were always quite set and very happy with our decisions on that. A lot of the qualities kind of reflected what I was like and what my interests were. So we thought it would be nice if, you know, biologically they would be from Amy, but to have, and obviously not guaranteeing the child gets any of those interests, but like it was kind of nice to think about it that way.
Yes.
But in hindsight, I think, I mean, we were very young
and
very, very naive to the whole journey. And I think the way that our story has ended up has been the way it needed to be.
Yeah.
But yeah, we didn't think too much about swapping donors at that point because we knew that if we had a fallen pregnant, we would have hopefully kept that donor so that all of our children had the same donor.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah.
Just to confirm, because I know that from friends who have been through a different clinic, they had to pick 3 donors and then essentially they got given one of their preferences.
Yeah.
Is that what happened with you guys?
Yeah. So remember you write down like 1 to 5, I think it is. And then, you know, on the day, if they're not available anymore because they've all been used up, you could get your second option.
And it's literally on the day.
Yeah.
Yeah. So you're prepping for these. And Amy's IUIs were medicated. So we were prepping for those. And sort of, yeah, on the day we went in for insemination was when we found out who the donor would be. It was pretty crazy.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah.
I could not handle that. When a friend told us, I'd never heard of it before, I didn't know that it was more common than I thought. Yeah. Because when we picked our donor through our fertility clinic, it was an anonymous donor as well. And we were like, this is the donor we're picking. This is it. We're reserving these vials. No one else can take our spot. And it was like signed, sealed right there. So I can't, I mean, if that's all you know, that's all you know.
We didn't have to reserve vials.
No.
Like with you guys, how you mentioned how you've had to reserve them and pay for those vials. We never had to do that. It was just once you chose a donor and were assigned to a donor, you became one of their five families that they could help. I guess that's why it changes so quickly, depending on who falls pregnant and who doesn't.
Okay. So that process is a little bit secure after the fact then. Okay, that's nice. In regards to then going through the early stages, did you guys have a counselling session?
Yeah, we did.
It was interesting. Yeah. The first one we did was on site, face to face, and we kind of had no idea what to expect. We sort of thought it would be just, oh, are you ready to have a baby? Do you understand how it's happening? Those kinds of things. But they actually sort of went into informing the kid, like, how would you inform your child that their donor conceived, and would you disclose it to them and things like that, which actually made us think a lot about how we would do that. So that was basically what our counselling session was about.
Yeah.
That's nice. I've had a lot of mixed reactions. A lot of people don't know that there is going to be a counselling session involved when they go through the IVF process with a donor-conceived baby. And I think that we have a similar experience to you girls. Well, initially, I was actually quite offended and taken back. I was like, I don't need someone to tell me how to raise my kid. It was a really positive session. And she said, well, you know, generally, this is the age that kids can start to understand that concept, and from experience this is when people tell them. And yeah, made us then go away and have the discussions, like, how are we going to approach it, what age are we going to look at telling her and stuff like that. So for anyone who is going through the process, I think it's really nice to hear that there can be quite positive, I know not all like this, but there can be quite positive counseling sessions. And yeah, they just want to know that you're prepared and to, like, help you navigate that journey. They're not working against you, they're trying to, I suppose, work for you. So that's really nice to know that you guys had a positive experience with that as well. You've gone back to the original clinic at 3 failed IUIs. Where do we go from there?
We actually had a break. It was
understandable.
About the time we were getting married, financially we were just kind of like, oh, we sort of had to put all of our time and money into getting married. So we actually approached a friend at the time. He'd been in our lives for a little bit but wasn't super close to, you know, worry about any boundaries and things like that, and asked if he would be willing to be a donor for us. So that's kind of where our home insemination journey started. And at the time it was just Amy. So she's always been very lucky and had a very regular cycle. So we kind of knew roughly when she would be ovulating and just tracked it. And then it's so strange looking back at it. basically just contacted him when we thought we would need donations, and he was more than happy to just come around to our house and help out.
Mm-hmm. And so then what happens with the anonymous donor that you were assigned at the clinic?
Because there were no pregnancies, they go back into the system of where people can choose them. So until there was a pregnancy, they are basically just sort of free game for anyone at that time.
With the home inseminations, is there anything besides cycle tracking that had to be done, like medications?
No, I guess because it was just purely our decision. It wasn't through a clinic or anything. It was just our decision just to see if anything would happen in the time that we were kind of trying to save money for our wedding. It was basically just a discussion between us and him as to what was going to happen and how we were going to go about it. And I think we went through maybe four donations.
4 months. We did sort of suss out whether legal action would be necessary beforehand, but everything we sort of read and everyone we spoke to said that basically anything, like if we'd had something drawn up legally, if he wanted to, he could overturn it anyway. We just took his word on it. I mean, a child wasn't conceived from that, but there's never been any issues with that. So we kind of just went with our gut.
Yeah.
4 months that were unsuccessful with that.
So, yeah, I guess after the wedding, we really started to get serious with the journey and where to go next.
And how is your headspace through all this, Amy?
Oh, everywhere. To be completely honest, it was, to me now looking back, it was such a blur. But at the time, I don't even know what I was thinking.
You just so desperately want to be pregnant, and you kind of will do anything that it takes, and you're like, okay, next month, okay, next one. Like, I've got this, let's keep doing it. And you just kind of soldier on, don't you?
Yeah, just trying to be as positive as I could.
And busy. You were so busy.
Yeah, I didn't stop.
No.
Yep.
Yeah. That helped me. You know, pushing things aside seemed to help me.
Yeah.
A lot of people probably not.
No, I'm the same. I have the biggest avoidance personality ever. Everything's shoved somewhere that I don't know about and don't have to deal with until it all comes out, maybe in 6 months' time.
Yeah, absolutely.
We had the wedding, had a little break, nice time together, and then kind of were like, all right, what's our next plan of attack? We've got a little bit of a clearer mindset moving forward. Yep.
Yeah, so then COVID started. So all of the initial, up until egg collection, everything else was pretty good, like access to medications and everything. We just started that schedule, which was, I think it was 2 injections daily and a nasal spray. Interesting.
What was the nasal spray?
I think it was instead of an injection. So we could have to have 3 injections a day.
Mm-hmm.
But Amy was like, no, 2's enough.
So fair. I think anyone would choose a nasal spray option over an injection.
Yeah, it was considerable.
Decreasing the secretions of sex hormones. So I think it was to stop you from ovulating prematurely. Yeah.
So too.
To let the
follicles. With all the stimulation.
Yeah.
Wow, that's a really interesting option that your clinic had. I love that.
Yeah.
I don't know why they wouldn't offer that too. Everyone.
Yeah. We've also recently learned that a lot of clinics use completely different medications. Like there's so many that we've never heard of, even though we've been through a fair bit of medication between the IUIs and IVF cycle. So I guess everyone is a bit different.
Yeah.
Started IVF injections. What did your egg retrieval look like?
Follicles were looking good. I can remember them saying something like, it was about in the 20s, and we're like, oh yeah, cool, that's just under ultrasound. Oh yeah, okay, everything's looking good. Went in, and I remember COVID times, so
I couldn't go in.
Yeah, Hill couldn't go in, so wait.
Out the front of the hospital for hours. Oh, I was just sitting there. I
love that.
And then I just remember waking up, and for some reason they write it on your hand. I don't know. So it's the first thing you look at in a daze, and you're looking at my hand, and yeah, it said 17. So I was happy enough with that. I mean, I would have been happy with one. 17 was pretty awesome. And then I just remember looking over across from me, and there was this lady that was basically in an induced coma, and on her hand it had 40 something. So I was kind of just really glad that that wasn't me.
Yeah, okay.
The severity of the situation when you're, you know, when you are using all of these medications to stimulate so many follicles and things like that, that it can go wrong.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of don't really think about when you're going through it. But our clinic did day 3 embryos instead of day 5.
Okay.
So 17, we were like, oh, that's, you know, that's a good number. That's promising.
Yeah.
So they called us the next day to see how many fertilized, and we had 14 that fertilized. We got very lucky with that.
Amazing.
They told us that we weren't going to hear from them until day 3, so 2 days later. So we just tried to stay as busy as we could, because that was terrifying.
The longest 48 hours of your entire life.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. We couldn't imagine the day 5 wait.
I just think to myself, why can't you just call us every day?
Yeah.
Like, because we had a day 5 and a day 6 wait. I'm like, why can't you just call us 8 o'clock in the morning? Like, sometimes it was a call at like 1 p.m. You wouldn't know when the phone call was coming. It was just when the embryologist got around to it. Yeah. And I'm like, just sit down at your desk, check all your little embryos, and give everyone a ring around.
Cool. Everyone else was freaking out. So from day 1, they were like, look, we expect that about half of them will make it and half of them won't. So we were kind of like, oh, 7, that would be amazing, would be such a blessing. And on day 3, we were out for breakfast and Amy got a phone call and I couldn't hear it, so I was stressing. But she had a big smile on her face. So we were like, cool, amazing. And they told us that 12 of our embryos made it.
Yay.
So had 12 frozen little babies. Amy was over the hyperstimulation, so we couldn't do
a fresh
transfer. We had to wait.
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah.
That would have been shitty news.
Yeah.
Because I know that we've been in that situation almost a couple of times where they've been like, we're not sure if you can do a fresh transfer, because a month is a long time to wait after everything you've been through.
Yeah. Because we'd moved back out of the mountains. So we were back in regional New South Wales. We stayed in Sydney for those 5 days after the egg collection, just in case they were to do a fresh cycle for us. So we ended up having to come home and then have that month wait back to the medications and all the fun stuff.
Yeah.
12 embryos.
Yeah. 12 embryos frozen.
Amazing.
Just started the frozen transfers, I guess, the month after.
Yeah.
Which, wasn't cheap, that's for sure.
No, we actually forgot because Mac was a frozen transfer, obviously, because she was my embryo and Maddie carried, but it was the first time, it was our only transfer, and we'd already thrown so much money at the process and it was our first time. But then the second time we started going through, it was almost $5,000 per transfer. I don't know what you guys are looking at. We completely forgot. I was like, I think it was like $1,000 and we maybe get like half back from Medicare, and then it was almost $5,000, and I was like, Maddie, I do not remember it being this expensive. And then when you go through multiple, even if you only go through one, it's a disgusting amount of money.
It's absolutely crazy. We basically back to back the transfers as much as we could, because we just wanted to get it done.
So the first transfer didn't work?
No, we did three transfers and none of them worked. And we called our clinic and we were like, what is happening? Like something has to be wrong, because we'd only ever got the news that Amy was happy, healthy, young, no issues. They turned around and they said to us, well, it's just like rolling a dice. And we were like, are you joking? Like, this is the most expensive, emotional, draining
board game that I've ever played.
Yeah, exactly. Like, we'd like to get off this game now if we possibly could. We kind of just took their word because we didn't know any different. We were like, oh, we'll try again. So we did another three transfers and none of those worked either. So we were up.
Were they all nothing? No, didn't implant at all?
No.
Wow.
So no, we had not by this point seen a positive pregnancy test. No. That's when Amy really spiraled.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Understandably, my gosh. Yeah.
I mean, we both did in different ways, and I think even to this day, that's still something we can't understand from each other's shoes. Like, we don't know what it's like to be the other person in the journey, but we threw everything at it, and we did a double transfer. So we transferred two embryos on transfer number 7.
Yeah, it's number 7.
And we found out the day after Christmas that it didn't work, and we were like, this is just too much for us. And financially as well, we were like, we can't keep doing it,
no.
Yeah. So we had a break after that because we needed it. We needed to sort of get ourselves back together, get back to being wives. I think we lost that.
We never straight from the wedding into...
From the wedding, hadn't really focused on
us together.
Ourselves.
Yeah.
As tough as it was initially to make that decision, we were kind of like, well, we really needed that.
Yeah.
That was all we had to do with that clinic.
And so did the clinic tell you anything, or did you guys do any research into what might be going, like what might be happening, any blood tests, naturopaths, like anything?
Yeah. Well, so we did a bit of research into it before we started retesting and things like that, but just ourselves. And we were kind of like, oh, it could have been chromosomal things. It could have been maybe, you know, endometriosis. Amy's family has quite a history of endometriosis, but she'd never shown up with anything in all the testing and stuff we'd done. And we kind of just tried to find ways to justify why it hadn't happened. The clinic basically shut off. I think they knew that we weren't happy and we wanted answers, but they couldn't really give it to us. So we just shut them off. We had embryos still frozen there for quite a while that we just left. Mentally, I think we couldn't think about what to do with those.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. So we just left them there and paid their little storage fee.
Kept giving them your money.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly what they wanted. But, yeah, so then we did find another clinic. We went with a publicly funded clinic because financially we couldn't do a private clinic again.
Yeah, I didn't know that was a thing.
Yeah, so there's a couple of clinics in New South Wales that are public clinics, and their prices are amazing, much cheaper. Like, just off the top of our heads, I think our IVF cycle at the private clinic was around 17,000, 18,000, like without medication, things like that.
Mm-hmm.
And then at the public clinics, they sit, under 5.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah.
It is so unregulated, I think. Our private clinic is around 13,000 for an IVF cycle.
Yeah.
And so that is wild that there's such a big difference between so many clinics.
Yeah, when they're all doing the same thing.
The same thing, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So we started with another clinic, another one to add to the list, and they did some more investigations, sort of deeply going into, they did a lot of genetic stuff, a deep infiltrating scan for endometriosis.
So did you have any genetic testing done prior?
No.
Or like your AMH levels or?
I think the AMH levels were in there and
fine. Yeah. Yeah. But in terms of genetics, no.
Nothing. Yeah. And so to go through the public fertility clinic, do you have to have a reason? Like, is it for infertility or?
They did ask us if we were just a same-sex couple looking for treatment initially, but we were like, no, we've actually been through all of this. Mm-hmm. And our specialist was like, well, we can definitely put an infertility tag on you.
Sure.
And then
kind
of like streamline straight through. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so they did the testing and they found a little bit of endometriosis right at the back of Amy's uterus, but they were kind of like, it's not really enough to warrant why things weren't happening.
Mm-hmm. Started all the process with them, and, you know, having to start a new clinic again means having to go through counselling and all that process. So it took a bit of time, obviously a few months.
Mm-hmm. And they told us that they didn't have a donor program, so we had to have a donor of our own and take them. Yeah, so that was kind of another hump that we met along the way, because we did actually contact our friend who we'd used just before we got married. Mm-hmm. Would you be interested in still donating? And he was like, I've kind of moved on in my life. I have a partner. And we're like, no, that is totally fine. We just wanted to touch base there. We do have a known donor. They were fine with all of the process and everything that needed to happen, because it was all screening of Amy and then screening of the donor.
So it's going to take a while.
Yeah. And then the 3-month quarantine. For yeah. We were kind of waiting on that.
Lucky you started so soon into, you know,
yeah,
being together in your ages and stuff. Oh my gosh.
Yeah. So we kind of waited for that time period, and then because we have to travel to meet up with our donor, we kind of just had to go with each cycle and hope that we were able to travel when Amy was ovulating to see if we could try, like, in the meantime while we were waiting for IVF.
Mm-hmm.
So it was January 2022. Mm-hmm. And we were actually going away for a photo shoot. Yeah, so we renewed our vows and had a photo shoot all in the same weekend, and we were away, so we were like, let's go.
Amy's, it's the weekend of love.
Yeah, Amy's like roughly ovulating. We'll see if he's free. The first time that we used that donor was when Bowie was conceived.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah, we were shocked. Amy walks. Amy walks into our bedroom at 10:30 at night. It was a Saturday. I'll never forget it. With the shakiest pregnancy test in her hand that I have ever seen, and I just cried. I just cried for ages, and Amy couldn't cry because she was just like, what the fuck is going on?
Yeah, I was in shock.
Yeah.
Wow. And so looking back on it now, do you think at the time there was anything, like, had you been trying to do anything different?
If anything, I tried to relax.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I tried to just be me, not worry about what I was eating, what I was drinking.
Mm-hmm.
Just tried to relax as best I could. You know, like, I think before all of it, I wouldn't mow the lawn because I was afraid that my heart rate would reach a certain level and that would ruin any chances. Whereas,
oh my gosh, it takes over your life, doesn't
it? It's very consuming. So I think just trying to relax a little more. And I think as well, knowing that this wasn't costing us money yet, really, I think the financial side played a big impact on me, definitely mentally, but also just overall, I was able to relax a little bit more. And I definitely think that helped, which, who knows what, maybe it was just the right connection.
Meant to be.
Yeah, but yeah, we were very lucky that was little Bowie.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Hillary, you're a bit of a house bitch for a long time then, by the sounds.
And I am again. The minute we found out, I was like, okay, don't do anything. Nothing. It's all on me. And Amy was quite unwell with Bowie up until about 17 weeks.
Yeah.
So it was kind of, you know, we had all the time in the world for her to rest. It's not easy. It's not easy, as you would know, being the one that's not carrying, because you're kind of like, you're in it too and it's your story too, but you're kind of like, well, they're pregnant, so everything needs to be about them and doting on them and all of that kind of
thing. Yes. And you're still working full time and, you know, you've got everything else that's going on in your life as well. Yeah. So it's crazy from both aspects, and obviously such a long journey emotionally, mentally, physically for you both as well. And both of you are like, well, I'm going through this, and the other one's like, yeah, but I'm going through this, and
yeah,
it's a lot. But amazing that it eventually happened. Yeah. And so what happened with the IVF clinic, you know, because you're in the quarantining period and the waiting period?
Yeah, so we waited 20 weeks.
Yeah, I think we did.
We were so scared that something was going to happen because we were kind of like, this is too good to be true. You know, we were waiting for the other ball to drop for so long. Yeah. And I think we kind of just told ourselves once we got to that 20-week mark, we were going to tell the clinic. So we told them and they were kind of like, oh, that's great. That's amazing. But we weren't expecting that to happen. Yeah. So we just sort of on hold and they said that we could go back to them anytime, you know, for further treatment or when I want to carry, we could go back to them. And it was at that point, actually, that we also made the decision to discard our embryos at the initial clinic.
Mm-hmm.
They were weighing so heavily, like, on our minds. And obviously being a different donor, and I think it was the best decision for us to just not have that.
Needed to move on from that clinic. And
close that chapter and move on. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Throughout this whole process to conceiving Bowie and then just briefly through the pregnancy, did you guys navigating the IVF journey have any issues in regards to being a same-sex couple? Did you experience any kind of lack of support or understanding or any kind of moments that stand out to you at all?
I think it's just the little, I'm like the admin person at home, so I make all the appointments and all of those kinds of things. And I think when you make them, they expect that it's you. And then when it's kind of like, oh no, my wife's pregnant, they're like, oh, well, she should be doing it. And I'm actually like, well, should she? Probably not, because she'll forget. Nothing really huge.
No, probably very lucky in that regard there.
Yeah. More of it sort of happened after Bowie was born. More of those like, oh, you know, he must look like his dad or things like that. And we're like, actually, no, especially when I would have him because people would be like, oh, well, he doesn't look like you. So who does he look like? Dad.
Why does it matter who he looks like, you know?
Exactly.
It's not important.
No. Yeah, I think the biggest part was just not, for me, not being acknowledged as mum as well. That was the biggest problem, I think, that we both kind of came across.
Yes. And that then contributes to the already imposter syndrome that you're feeling as the non-birthing parent. I explain it like I felt like a fraud in the sense of like, I didn't carry you and I didn't birth you and, you know, all of that, like with Maddie, she breastfed, I didn't breastfeed Mac. And so I already felt like I was like, well, how did I even get this child kind of thing? And so then, when you have all those external comments and everything, that just adds to how you're already feeling. I think speaking to other non-birthing mums, it's a pretty common feeling across the board. But also if you don't know another non-birthing mum and your partner who's the birthing mum, they can't resonate with you as much as they're trying to be there and support you, and you both know that you're the mums. It's a different world to navigate, that's for sure.
From wanting to carry and always wanting to have a child that's biologically mine, I knew that there may be hurdles that came up with being pregnant and carrying and birthing and, you know, getting to have that time at home afterwards. I knew there'd be hurdles, but I don't think until we went through it we realized how tough it would be for both of us in different ways, I think.
Yeah.
Which is quite challenging to navigate. Yeah.
Yeah, for sure. When going through IVF, we kind of, our experience is you kind of get lumped with everyone else that's going through IVF, such as like straight women who are going through infertility. And so you have to, like for us, we were going through extra monitoring and extra checks. And we had like, we were a high risk pregnancy because we're an IVF pregnancy. And so what did that look like for you guys? Because you'd obviously had such a big journey and then fallen pregnant through home insemination. What did that conversation look like with the birthing team?
I guess we were very lucky in that regard as well, as because it was home insemination, we weren't classed as high risk, even though we did have one hell of a journey to conceive Bowie.
They were a bit confused to start off with.
Yeah.
They were kind of like, what? Going on? And then I remember one midwife being like, oh, I just have to check how we class you with this because we don't actually know. And we kind of said, well, he was conceived with no medication, no nothing. So we didn't think it was fair to be deemed as high risk in that point. And we ended up, just sort of sailing through.
Yeah.
The only extra checkup we had was a scan because your placenta was a bit low, but it was fine. And that was that.
That was it, yeah.
Yeah, you kind of have to, in a way, like negate the whole journey and be like, no, well, this is how we conceive. So this is my pregnancy.
Yeah.
And yeah, the other stuff, I guess, is technically irrelevant.
Yeah.
Obviously super relevant, but technically in that moment.
Yeah.
And so just briefly, Amy, I know that you're pregnant again, which is incredible and very exciting. So did you want to talk us through your second journey and what that kind of looked like?
Definitely. Yeah, look, I guess originally who was going to carry number two. We had been trying whenever we could with our donor that was helping us out, that helped us conceive Bowie.
I was actually on letrozole for those cycles. So we talked back to the public clinic that we went through. We'd spoken to them about wanting to try again. They put me on letrozole while we did all the re-workups of everything.
And what's that?
Letrozole, it helps you ovulate. So it's just a tablet that you take on day two to day six of your cycle, and it helps you ovulate because I have issues with all of that. Bowie was 3 months old
when we started again.
Yeah. We didn't really care how close they were. We kind of just wanted to on the train.
Probably a little bit of subconscious trauma from the previous long experience with Bowie.
Yeah.
Definitely. Yeah. And I guess that is, you know, if it all works out, which obviously, like, more often than not, unfortunately, it seems like it takes longer than expected. But it is a bit of a pro of having two uteruses if you both want to carry. Poor Maddie, I'm not overly interested. But yeah, you can have that option to have them closer together, which is really nice if you like.
Yeah, so we kind of, it was 12 months of me trying and nothing was going on. So we went back to the clinic and we were like, look, let's go with IVF. Like, we don't want to sort of mess around with this anymore. And they were like, yep, let's go ahead. And then 2 hours later, I got a phone call and they were like, I'm so sorry, we no longer support donor programs. And we were like, what the heck is going on? So they referred us to another clinic and they were like, this clinic is really good to go to them. And we were like, sweet. So we started again. Yeah, we started again with a different clinic. So all of the initial appointments, counseling, the 3 months quarantine again, which it was heartbreaking.
They can't transfer any of that stuff over. They can't say you've done 700 counseling sessions. I think they're just fine.
Yeah. And having already had a kid, we just thought that maybe they'd let that slide. We thought that maybe they'd let the 3 month quarantine slide because we had already been using the donor. If there was going to be any issues, we would know by now. Yeah, no. So we've had to start again. We're still in that process. So it was November last year.
Yeah.
And I was sort of really down in the dumps about everything. And I was like, you know what? Let's just both try until we can get the clinic up and running, all that stuff. So we both tried. It was actually the one time we both ovulated at the same time, which was really handy for traveling. So we both tried that in November.
Yeah.
Two weeks later,
I was sitting on the couch feeling a bit bloated and I was like, oh, I feel a bit off today. And he was like, go and do a test. And I was like, no. Yeah. I went and did a test and I was like, nah, it's nothing. So I walked away from it. And literally a few minutes later, Hill walked in and she was like, you have to be kidding.
You bitch.
Big laugh, big smile. I couldn't believe it either.
She's like, that's not a line and you're seeing things. And I was like, Amy, it's a fucking line. We actually called my sister and I was like, what is it? What can you see on this? And she was just as shocked as us. She was like, what is going on? What is happening? Because she was like expecting it to be me. But then I was like, it's Amy. And she was kind of like, what? What is going on? So it was all just a really big shock. And I think for the first a couple of weeks, we kind of ignored it, but not intentionally. We were just like, what is happening?
It's an absolute blessing.
Oh, yes, absolute blessing.
We didn't expect it, which kind of more exciting.
Yeah, but I remember a couple of weeks after I spiraled because I was kind of.
I was just about to ask how, because you're then still mourning
not
falling pregnant.
Yeah, so the first week after we found out, I was buzzing because I was like, oh, my God, we're having another baby. Like, this is amazing. And then I just fell apart. for a long time, which wasn't fair on Amy, because every moment of a pregnancy should be, you know, and not necessarily for the person carrying because she was sick again. But like for me as a partner, I'm like, it should be a blessing, you know, it should be celebrated. I should be doting on her. But there was a point there where I was like, suck it up, Amy. You don't get to be sick. You don't get to be tired because you're pregnant. Mm-hmm. It's, you know, a blessing, which is not fair at all. But it was kind of just the way that I dealt with it at the time.
That is so common. We have friends who have been through a similar experience where they were both trying and one couldn't fall pregnant and the other one did fall pregnant. And she went through the exact same emotion. Yeah. She was like, just be grateful that you're pregnant because I can't fall pregnant.
Yeah.
And so both parties are so valid. Yeah. Like you're still human and you're still going through your own emotions, whatever that may be, you know, career pressures, home life pressures, fertility pressures, like you're still going through your own issues and you're your own separate person. So mm-hmm. I think everyone's feelings in that situation are completely valid. Yeah. But that would have been so hard for both of you.
Yeah.
Because then Amy, you're feeling awful and you're like, yeah, but I should be grateful yeah. that I'm pregnant, but I feel like shit.
Yeah. That's, so and we did have that conversation before we both did try at the same time. And, you know, I was very hesitant. I was like, are you sure this is something that you want?
Yeah. It came down to my decision. Yeah. She didn't want to take mm-hmm. in the decision other than being okay with it if that's what I chose.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it, honestly, now having had 24 weeks to sort of come to terms with everything, it's been the biggest blessing because I've had to have a lot more investigations into my fertility than I thought I would. So, if you know, we could have just been sitting mm-hmm. around waiting for all of this to happen. Our boys will be 21 months apart, which is really nice. It's mm-hmm. it's a blessing.
That is nice.
Yeah.
Oh, good. So you're still going to continue going through the process?
Yeah. Yeah. So we've got a couple more months wait
before we can start.
So we could actually start mm-hmm. IVF the month the baby's due, which might be a bit too much. so we might hold on a couple of months and, go from there.
Yeah. Oh, that's a whole another decision. I know there's so much to process in this last 50 minutes, but that is a whole nother decision in itself as well. Like I think we are in a kind of similar-ish boat. I've never even tried to go through the IVF journey. Like I had an egg retrieval and it was pretty average. Like I only got 4 eggs and only 1 fertilized. Mm-hmm. But if we're having a third, which we do want, Maddie's like, I don't think I'm interested in carrying a third. And she's had such a rough time trying to fall pregnant and now falling pregnant with this one. But I still don't really want to carry. But I could have, like, we have 1 embryo left. So I could have the option to do a transfer from now onwards at any point. And we're like, we could do a transfer when this one's almost due or just when it's a newborn. I've got to get into a headspace to make the final decision whether I want to carry or not. Because yeah, Maddie said if she is to carry the third, it will be quite a long time before she's probably ready again to do the third.
Yeah.
And so yeah, I totally understand having that, like, well, what are we gonna do? I can start when we've got a newborn, but you've got a toddler and a newborn.
Yeah.
And then a pregnant person. Like, that's wild.
Yeah, let's just have the third 6 months later. It'll just really
lesbians are crazy.
Oh my god, I know. And I think having that option, like, we have that option to do it or to try.
Yeah.
So we're kind of like, well, let's just do it. But then I guess mm-hmm. you've got to think about what happens when they are 6 months apart with a toddler. Yeah, what that looks like for everyone.
Yeah. I think so. Like, we've had so many people say to us, so why don't you just both get pregnant? And I'm like, have you actually thought about the logistics of that? Like, that would be great in theory, but mm-hmm. 2 pregnant women, 2 newborns, 2 postpartum phases.
Yeah.
Like, it's wild.
Thank God we weren't pregnant at the same time, first trimester at the same time, because nothing would have functioned. Poor Bowie would have been on his own.
He has to raise the kids.
Yep. Amazing. It should be.
Oh, well, thank you guys so much for sharing your journey. Wow. I take my hat off to both of you. You have been through so much and you should give yourselves credit for mentally, physically, emotionally, what you guys have been through separately, what you've been through as wives and as a family. It is, looking from the outside in, it is so incredible, and you're absolute warriors, both of you. So thank you so much for sharing that with me and for everyone. I think there is so much value in your journey, and I know that so many people are going to get comfort out of that. They're going to get knowledge and education. So it was incredible, and best of luck, Amy, for your pregnancy, and Hillary going through IVF whenever you make the crazy decision to want to start trying again.
Thank you so much.
That's okay. I really appreciate it. And you guys enjoy the rest of your day.
Yeah. You too.
Bye.
Bye.
Thank you all so much for listening today. If you'd like to connect with us and stay up to date with our day-to-day life, as well as future episodes, you can do so on our socials at those.2mums. We absolutely love bringing you these conversations each week. So if you love it too, please subscribe and leave us a review. Chat to you all next week. Bye.